Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the third in our Chancellor's Reflect series, which is also the third in the series which could also be entitled My Former Employers, because I worked as an official for Dennis Healy and then also as a Treasury official for Geoffrey Howe, and also as a Treasury official for Nigel Lawson, when I was on the home finance part, when he was financial secretary. And I then left and went to McKinsey, but our lives were then thrown together in a rather unusual and initially perhaps somewhat unfortunate way, in that at that time, Nigel's special advisor and speechwriter was one Michael Portillo. And the Brighton bomb, which killed the Prime Minister, did sadly kill Tony Berry, who was the MP for Enfield, and Michael Portillo inherited that seat, leaving a gap in the Treasury, which, after a bit of negotiation, I filled for a year. And I well remember, Nigel, as you may not, that we interviewed me, I think it was in February, and I think it was the day on which the pound hit $1.04. But things, as soon as I was appointed, things looked up. I worked with Nigel for two budgets, which was for me a very exciting time, and he was a fantastic person to work for. Whether I was such a fantastic support to him, I'm not sure, because I can remember in the middle of one budget discussion when Peter Cropper, and maybe, yes, indeed, he is here, and I and one other special advisor, the three in the Treasury at the time, were talking, and Nigel stopped and said, "My problem is that all my special advisors are supporters of the bloody SDP." And I'm not sure we were quite as strong a support to him as we might have been at that point. But we're delighted to have Nigel here tonight, and that gives me a good opportunity to remind you about mobile phones. And while we speak, mobile phones, something which was not a problem when we were working together in the Treasury. We have heard from Dennis Healy, we've heard from Geoffrey Howe, except for entirely logical that we should hear from you next, Nigel. We're greatly looking forward to your reflections on your time as Chancellor.
Well, good evening, and I must say it's a tremendous honour to be speaking this evening in the portals of an academic institution of such international renown. And it is a particular pleasure to be doing so at the request and indeed under the chairmanship of your director, Howard Davies. He has told of our previous relationships together. He needn't have worried. I knew how good he was. Modesty, of course, is not one of his characteristics, but that doesn't matter. He was always, when I first met him as a junior, when he was a junior civil servant, the Treasury Arms Financial Secretary, he was intelligent, articulate, he was ambitious, and supremely irreverent. And those were qualities which I thought would make him an excellent special advisor, and indeed he was. I don't think he was ever a member of the SDP. He has always been far too opportunist to join in any committed way any political party. He has always been intelligently promiscuous. Anyhow, to get to the subject, which the preamble of this series of lectures by a clutch of recent chancellors promises that, and I quote from the blurb, each speaker will shed light on the challenges faced during their time in office and provide a personal account of how these were tackled. Well, yes, up to a point, Lord Copper. But most of us have already done this in our published memoirs. And there is, I think, little point in going over the same ground again. Needless to say, When we come to the question and answer part of this evening's proceedings, I shall be more than happy to answer questions on any of that. But for now, I thought it might be more sensible to stand back a little and reflect more deeply, both on the lessons of those years and, in the light of my experience as Chancellor, on the conduct and limits of economic policy in general. And to make sense of it, I begin not from the start of my own chancellorship in 1983, but from the coming of the Thatcher government 4 years earlier in 1979. Because, of course, that was the watershed in which I was deeply involved as Financial Secretary to the Treasury under Geoffrey Howe for the crucially important first 2 years of the new government from 1979 to 1981. And my own subsequent six-year tenure was essentially a matter of continuing and further developing the new approach to economic policy in this country on which we had already embarked. But what we were engaged in was nothing less than changing the consensus about the proper conduct of economic policy. And that is something that can't be carried out overnight. It requires at least a decade to achieve. The circumstances in which we took office made the task both more difficult and less difficult than it might have been. It's hard to recall now the depths to which Britain had sunk a quarter of a century ago. Economic growth outside North Sea oil and gas had long been lagging the rest of Europe, and in the most recent cycle had virtually ground to a halt. In the despairing words of the Bank of England's March 1978 bulletin, and I quote, "Now condemned to very slow growth, we might later even have to accept, if present trends continue, declines in real living standards." Inflation at that time was in double figures and still rising. Management had all but ceased to manage. Increasing trade union militancy, culminating in the so-called winter of discontent of 1978 to 79, had raised the question on all sides of the political debate of whether the country had in fact become ungovernable. Pitied abroad, where Britain had been largely written off by other governments and the financial markets alike as the terminally sick man of Europe, we were mired in an all-pervasive defeatism at home. It was clearly not an easy inheritance. Yet there was one important sense in which the task with which we were faced was eased. For the inheritance was created not by one government or one political party. It was a result of the cumulative failure of the consensus that had shaped the conduct of economic policy by all governments pretty well ever since the war. It was clear to a demoralized official treasury that that consensus had been tested to destruction, with the result that although senior officials were skeptical, to say the least, of the new course we decided to chart, they had no alternative to offer. And it was also clear to the public at large that things had become so bad that unpalatable medicine probably had to be swallowed if the patient was to be cured. Essentially, the framework of the new approach consisted of three interconnected principles, each of them a reversal of the post-war conventional wisdom, as I subsequently set out in my 1984 May's lecture, a year after I became Chancellor. The first principle was that the recipe for economic success is the greatest practicable market freedom within an overall framework of financial discipline. By contrast, the approach that culminated in the debacle of the 1970s had in practice consisted of an ever-increasing erosion of market freedom, accompanied by the progressive abandonment of financial discipline. The second principle was that instead of seeking to use macroeconomic policy, in other words, monetary policy, so far as that thing existed at that time, but essentially fiscal policy, to promote growth and employment, and microeconomic policy, of which prices and incomes policy was the central component, to suppress inflation, we should do precisely the reverse. In other words, the government of the day should direct macroeconomic policy, preeminently in the form of monetary policy, to suppress inflation, and microeconomic or supply-side policy, such as tax reform, labour market reform, deregulation, privatisation, and the promotion of competition, to provide all the other conditions most favourable to improved performance in terms of growth and employment. And the third principle was to set all this explicitly within a medium-term context. The most obvious formal expression of this was the medium-term financial strategy. But behind the MTFS, there lay a more profound reversal of the old post-war consensus, according to which the overriding object of the Chancellor's policies was a largely vain, quasi-Keynesian attempt to eradicate, or at least greatly diminish, the vagaries of the typical business cycle, about which policymakers can in reality do very little, and to focus instead on the conditions for improved economic performance over the longer term, about which history, both here and throughout the world, teaches us that a great deal can be done, even though it can take a while for the results to become apparent. How then did all this work out in practice, particularly, of course, during my own watch? Needless to say, not perfectly. There were a variety of problems and setbacks, alarums and excursions on the way, all of which I recount in my memoirs. The most painful of these came towards the end with the so-called Lawson boom of the late 1980s, which brought with it a regrettable resurgence of inflation, albeit to well under half the level from which we had brought it down. This was essentially a consumer credit boom alongside a business investment boom, at the heart of which was a housing bubble which had been exacerbated by the once-for-all effects of financial deregulation. With hindsight, it is clear that monetary policy should have been tightened earlier than it was. But with the best will in the world, there is no way in which the monetary authorities can fine-tune bank lending any more than they can fine-tune expectations. As indeed Keynes pointed out in the general theory, and I quote, "A boom is a situation in which over-optimism triumphs over a rate of interest which in a cooler light would be seen as excessive." And there was certainly a lot of over-optimism around at that time. Nor, of course, is there any way the authorities can predict the point at which the credit cycle is likely to turn of its own accord, or indeed a bubble to burst, although turn it inevitably will. Matters were further complicated in the second half of the 1980s, first by the unreliability of the official statistics, which persistently, seriously underestimated the strength of the boom, and then by the Wall Street crash of September 1987, when the tightening of monetary policy, which had already begun in the UK, was reversed here as elsewhere, amid fears that the crash heralded a world recession. Moreover, it should be recalled that throughout 1986 and 1987, inflation was running at some 3% a year, too high for comfort, but not in itself threatening. I hope that the statistics on which the Bank of England nowadays makes the sophisticated short-term forecasts, on which its interest rate decisions so substantially depend, are of a better quality than those on which I had to rely. But even if they are, it is a myth to suppose that even the most capable of monetary authorities can ensure that the path of economic activity is at all times a straight line. For the sake of completeness, I mustn't leave out the proposition advanced by some that the problem was caused by my decision in the wake of the Louvre Accord of February 1987 to maintain an informal exchange rate link between sterling and the Deutschmark, the period of so-called shadowing the Deutschmark, which ended in March 1988 as a proxy for ERM membership. I don't really believe that this stands up, not least because, as Friedman famously pointed out, monetary policy works with long and variable lags. We have to go back earlier, certainly to 1986, when monetary conditions had inadvertently been eased by the sharp fall in sterling, for the period when, in hindsight, we can now see that policy, as I said earlier, became inadequately tight. Most of those who point the finger at the shadowing episode do so, I believe, out of a distaste for any kind of fixed exchange rate. Now, I have considerable sympathy with them, in the sense that in the long term, rigidly fixed exchange rates are an economic nonsense. But to get inflation down, it helps to have a form of monetary discipline that enjoys a modicum of market credibility. By the mid-1980s, domestic monetary targeting had clearly lost that credibility, nor was it helped by bitter internecine strife among the Simon Pure monetarists themselves as to which kind of money, broad or narrow, mattered, or indeed, if nothing short of full-blooded monetary base control was any use at all. Moreover, history has clearly shown that an external discipline can indeed acquire market credibility. The gold standard undoubtedly enjoyed it during the conspicuously successful period up to the First World War, but that is an era gone beyond recall. Bretton Woods, too, enjoyed market credibility for a number of years after the Second World War, but that, too, is gone beyond recall. In the mid-1980s, when I was looking for something to replace the distinctly shop-soiled practice of monetary targeting, the ERM, of which the Deutschmark was the anchor currency, had come to enjoy considerable market credibility, and I believed that a period of this external discipline would assist in the final stages of eradicating inflation and inflationary expectations, as indeed it undoubtedly assisted France. But that era, too, is now gone beyond recall. The mishandling of the economic consequences of German reunification, which occurred soon after I had left office, severely damaged the ERM, but the death knell was the Maastricht Treaty at the end of 1991, which effectively replaced it with the essentially political project of European Monetary Union, the single currency, leaving this vestigial ERM merely as an antechamber to EMU, with no market credibility of its own at all. Today, market credibility has been secured by entrusting the conduct of monetary policy to an independent Bank of England, far and away the best decision that Gordon Brown has taken, which has done an excellent job over the past 7 years. As many of you will know, this was something I sought to do in 1988, but was unable to persuade Margaret Thatcher to agree with, and I launched it into the public debate in my resignation speech in October 1989. But Margaret did have a point. Inflation, which, as I mentioned, had fallen to 3% in 1986 and 1987, was on the way up again in 1988, although the Treasury forecast at the time was that it would peak in 1989 and then resume its downward path. But the forecast was uncertain and indeed to be proved badly wrong, and independence granted at that time might have looked, as Alan Budd recently noted, as if the bank was being asked to succeed where politicians had failed. As it was, thanks both to the severe monetary tightening I instituted during my last year in office and the policies implemented by my three successors, John Major, Norman Lamont, and Kenneth Clark, inflation, having peaked at some 7.5% in 1991, did indeed resume its downward path, hovering around 2.5% during the 4 years from 1993 to 1996. And by 1997, when Gordon Brown took office and very sensibly immediately gave the bank operational independence, it was down to 2%. I should add that I throughout used the Consumer Prices Index in terms of which the bank's target is nowadays defined. Thus, the bank's task was not that of getting inflation and inflationary expectations down, but the much less difficult one of keeping them down, a task it has carried out with great skill and acquired in the process a valuable track record, and it's done so, incidentally, without any reliance whatever on monetary targeting. It has, of course, got an inflation target, but that's a different matter altogether, not least because an inflation target, when you're already there or thereabouts, enjoys a credibility which would have been entirely lacking in the difficult circumstances of the 1980s. Of course, as Mervyn King has put it, The past 10 years have been the nice decade. Nice standing, he says, for non-inflationary constant expansion. And this has been true not just for the UK, but for most of the developed world. The next decade, he rightly suggests, may not be as nice, and certainly not as nice and easy. But there is one fundamental respect in which the world today is very different from and very much better than the world we knew in the 1980s and earlier. The coming of globalization, or rather the second coming, because it was the condition of the remarkably successful half century between the end of the American Civil War and the outbreak of the First World War, a period rightly dubbed the Belle Époque. The coming of globalization as a result of the worldwide move to freedom of capital markets, where this country, incidentally, was something of a pioneer, coupled with the emergence of China as a major player in the global economy, has not only improved world growth, but crucially made the world economy a vastly more competitive marketplace than it was before. And there is nothing like an increase in competition to facilitate the task of preserving stable prices. In parenthesis, I would add here that the monetarists, in my judgment, do themselves no favors by moving from the correct analysis that inflation is caused by the excessive printing of money to the false assumption that monetary authorities engage in this either out of stupidity, venality, or just for the hell of it, rather than in response to pressures in the real world. Be that as it may, in the context of the thesis of my remarks tonight, the important lesson of this experience is, I believe, twofold. First, the fundamentally new approach we put in place in 1979 and persisted with thereafter did indeed succeed in eliminating inflation, where the old one had conspicuously failed. And it was this success that led naturally to institutionalizing it by entrusting the conduct of anti-inflation policy to an independent Bank of England with an unequivocal remit to maintain price stability. Second, the fact that this important change was important institutional change was enacted by the other political party in a two-party system is clear evidence that at the macroeconomic level the consensus had indeed changed. And at the microeconomic level, I believe that despite some regrettable backsliding, notably in the spheres of taxation and regulation, the consensus has also unequivocally changed. The old notion that the promotion of growth and employment should be undertaken via a neo-Keynesian policy of budget deficits has been universally discarded, and the contrary proposition, to which we doggedly adhered, that this was the proper and exclusive object of microeconomic policy, essentially through enabling the competitive capitalist market economy to work better, has in effect been adopted by New Labour. Again, this occurred because the new approach, involving deregulation, tax reform, social security reform, labour market reform, privatisation and all the rest, so clearly worked, as indeed was recognised throughout the world. I certainly don't wish tonight to enumerate the multitude of measures we took in this context. In Isaiah Berlin's terms, macroeconomic policy is the province of the hedgehog and microeconomic policy that of the fox. That's to say, macroeconomic policy is one big thing, whereas microeconomic policy consists of a myriad of, for the most part, relatively small things which cumulatively become very important indeed. But if I had to choose between the two achievements of Geoffrey Howe's time and mine, getting inflation down and reforming the supply side of the economy, both of which were, of course, essential, I would say that the second was the more difficult and thus the greater of the two. I do so on the basis of a simple test. Throughout most of Europe, the 1970s were a worryingly inflationary decade. Yet although the details varied from country to country, every established member of the European Union has succeeded in getting inflation down. The 1970s, of course, also saw the European economy become increasingly sclerotic and underperforming. Yet although our partners on the continent gradually reached the same conclusion as we had done, or at least paid lip service to it, namely that the essential remedy was a full-blooded program of supply-side reform to remove rigidities and enable the market to work better. For the most part, they have failed to get very far, finding it too unpalatable or else too difficult. It was, incidentally, only after I'd ceased to be Chancellor that I discovered that some 20 years ago, Hayek, that great ornament of the London School of Economics before the war, when asked to say something about his differences with Keynesian economics, had replied slightly surprisingly in these terms. And I quote, "Keynes, against his intentions, had stimulated the development of macroeconomics. I was convinced that not only his particular conclusions, but the whole formulation of macroeconomics was wrong. So I wanted to demonstrate that we had to return to microeconomics." End of quote. In practical political and public policy terms, of course, that is a great deal easier said than done. But it's important that it is done, and important, too, to recognize that what it does not mean is a shift of emphasis from government macro-management to government micro-management. So the 1980s were a period of fundamental change in the conduct of economic policy in this country. But there were at least two important respects in which the nature of the job of Chancellor didn't change at all in my time, nor is it likely to do so, I suspect. If the Treasury were to have an institutional motto, it would be the single word, no. For at the heart of the Treasury's roles and responsibilities lies the tedious but essential task of the control of public expenditure. It's this that puts the Chancellor at odds with most, if not all, of his colleagues, and which make his, if he's really doing his job, the loneliest job in government. I suspect I was the only Chancellor since the war to have presided over a substantial reduction in public expenditure as a share of GDP, and it was this which enabled me to eliminate the PSBR and achieve a budget surplus, despite significant cuts in rates of taxation. But it was a very time-consuming business, in which I was enormously assisted by a succession of four able chief secretaries, Peter East, John McGregor, John Major, and Norman Lamont, by the steadfast support of the Prime Minister, and last but not least, by the high quality of the official Treasury. One of the greatest joys of being Chancellor, a job which you may or may not be surprised to learn is not all joy, is the exceptional calibre of the great majority of Treasury officials. The other unchanging and rather less well understood aspect of the job is connected with the task of public expenditure control, but it transcends it. Unlike the case in most other countries, the Treasury is a great deal more than a finance ministry. It is also, both in name and in reality, the central department, which means that the Chancellor, like, of course, the Prime Minister, but unlike any other minister, has a finger in pretty well every pie that the government bakes. While this no doubt stems principally from the fact that there's a public expenditure dimension to most government policies and an economic dimension to almost everything, it is entrenched in the UK by the customary conventions and procedures of government, which I have no reason to believe have changed. To take just one example, no minister may put a proposal to Cabinet without first submitting it to the Treasury, which has a right to insert a paragraph of its own, dissenting from all or part of the proposal and explaining its reasons for doing so. Thus, while as Chancellor, my direct responsibility for supply-side reform lay in the admittedly important areas of tax reform, financial deregulation, and the privatization program for which the Treasury had overall responsibility, I was also able to take advantage of this central role to become deeply involved in those aspects of supply-side reform in which the Treasury was not, in fact, the lead department. But although, once again, a very time-consuming business, this aspect of the Chancellor is, I believe, important to any administration which desires to ensure what I would call policy coherence, but which seems to be known nowadays as joined-up government. But while much has stayed the same, much too has changed. I've already noted how the wider economic environment has been transformed by the second coming of globalization, and within that context, by a large part of the third world, most conspicuously, but not only China, embracing the market economy and happily making unprecedented economic progress as a result. Indeed, there's now almost a sense of terror in some quarters of the richer world that some of the poorer countries are becoming rich at our expense, leading to a resurgence of protectionist sentiment which it is essential to resist. But along with the new global economic environment, there have come new challenges too. Let me tonight mention just two of them. One of which is itself global in nature, and the other which is a particular challenge to this country. The first of the two new challenges which I wish to touch on is the threat of climate change or global warming. This is an area where Her Majesty's Treasury has an important role to play, and so far as I am aware, is failing to play it. That global warming is a major challenge we have on the authority of no less an expert than the present Prime Minister, who, it has to be said, has something of a penchant for apocalyptic warnings based on flimsy evidence. But insofar as there's any hard evidence of global warming as a secular rather than a cyclical phenomenon, it comes from the steady increase in so-called greenhouse gas emissions from the growing consumption of carbon-based energy to fuel global economic growth. And the likely future rate of global economic growth is a matter on which economic expertise is more relevant than any other. For the likely rate of global warming is as important as the question of whether or not it is occurring. Mankind has shown itself to be astonishingly adaptable, and the market is a remarkably successful instrument for harnessing that adaptability. But clearly, the more rapid the rate of climate change, the stronger the case for government intervention in this area. So a dispassionate economic assessment is badly needed. Yet so far from undertaking this, the Treasury seems to be content to leave the matter entirely in the hands of what used to be known as the Department of the Environment, nowadays DEFRA, which of course has a vested departmental interest in maximizing the gravity of the threat. This is why the Treasury's traditional role as the dispassionate and objective central department, not merely in the field of public expenditure but more widely, has always been considered so necessary. It seems that over global warming, it has entirely abdicated that responsibility, even so far as the essential task of cost-benefit analysis is concerned. For, obviously, if the costs of action taken to reduce global warming exceed the benefit from the extent to which global warming is reduced, then such action should not be undertaken. The Treasury's apparent abdication is all the more serious because DEFRA, in turn, has largely contracted out the analysis of this important issue to an international quango, the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, known to its friends as the IPCC, which not only has an even greater vested interest in maximizing the scale of the threat and thus of its own importance, but which has shown a determination to suppress or ignore dissenting views and reasoned criticism that is little short of a scandal. This is, in fact, part of a wider problem. It is, I believe, no accident that it is in Europe that climate change absolutism has found the most fertile soil. For it's Europe that has become the most secular society in the world, where the traditional religions have the weakest popular hold. Yet people still feel, and no doubt always will, the need for the comfort that the transcendent certainties of religion can provide. And it is what might be termed the quasi-religion of greenery, which has filled the vacuum with reasoned questioning of any of its mantras regarded as a form of blasphemy. I hope I am not alone in finding this mindset profoundly disquieting as well as economically harmful. Unlike global warming, the other new challenge facing the Treasury and the Chancellor is, as I have indicated, a matter for this country alone. It is, of course, the question of whether we should join the European Monetary Union and exchange our own currency for the euro. So much has been written about this that I will do little more than indicate where I stand. It's no secret that European Monetary Union is a political and not an economic project. In the first place, in an age of globalization, the economic context is clearly global rather than regional. And in the second place, in purely economic terms, there can be little dispute that the imposition of a single monetary policy over an area as large and diverse as the European Union, with its many different languages, cultures, and traditions, is undesirable. How much economic damage it is likely to cause to the various peoples of the Union over time is, I think, very difficult to predict. In normal times, I suspect the cost may not be very great, although it is, of course, cumulative. But circumstances could arise, the so-called asymmetric shocks, when the harm would be considerable. This is the overriding economic consideration, which none of Gordon Brown's celebrated five tests really touch. Treasury, of course, is well aware of this. Hence the proposal buried away in the voluminous study of British Euro membership it published last year and subsequently promoted by the Chancellor's Chief Economic Advisor, that the problem could and should be addressed by reverting to neo-Keynesian fiscal fine-tuning. Surely we have all had more than enough experience of fiscal fine-tuning in this country to know not only that it doesn't really work in macroeconomic terms, but that it inflicts considerable microeconomic damage. So the question essentially boils down to this: whether it's in our national interest to pay an economic price of uncertain magnitude, coupled with the political price of giving up a major element of self-government, in return for the undefined political benefit of being at the heart of Europe. Not that EMU membership alone would put us at the heart of Europe anyway. It clearly cannot be. Of course, I recognize that there are some who find the whole concept of national interest objectionable. In an age of globalization, it's argued, the nation-state has become an anachronism. History, I believe, provides the simplest refutation of this very muddled thesis. For the late 19th century is widely recognized as having been the heyday of the nation-state, and it was also, as I've already mentioned, the epoch which saw the first coming of economic globalization. Others argue that whether or not the nation-state has in fact become obsolete, it certainly ought to be, given the havoc that nationalism has wreaked over the past 100 years. Now, there are three great forces that make the weather that governments have to steer through. These are self-interest, including in that term the interests of one's children, nationalism, and religion. Each of them can certainly turn ugly, but each of them can also be a force for good. It makes no more sense to reject nationalism tout court because of its evil exploitation by Nazi Germany than to reject religion tout court because of the excesses of militant Islamic fundamentalism. So far as self-interest is concerned, Adam Smith long ago demonstrated how the market economy can channel this into public benefit. But nationalism is important too in this context. It is no historical accident that the evolution of the nation-state and the evolution of the market economy precisely coincided. For the market economy rests on a non-economic infrastructure, of which a vital component is the rule of law. And in a free society, the rule of law will work satisfactorily only if the people feel that in the last resort it is their law. Well, the rediscovery of the market economy is not by any means the whole of the new consensus I've made the principal theme of this talk, but it is the most important component. There's nothing ideological about the market. I admit personally to placing quite a high value on individual freedom, but there are certainly other important values as well. The dominance of the market economy in the world today is essentially Darwinian, a matter of the survival of the fittest, as rival systems have been tested to destruction. And there are good reasons why this should have been so. There is the great benefit of competition, which only the market can fully provide. There is the Hayekian point that the market is an unbeatable signaling system, providing and diffusing the information required for rational business and consumer decisions on a scale to which no other system can remotely aspire. These are both compelling reasons, but to my mind the most compelling of all is that the most fundamental fact of economic life, as indeed of all other dimensions of life, is that we are all fallible. We all make mistakes, and we always will. Markets certainly make mistakes, but so do governments. Businessmen make mistakes, and so do politicians and bureaucrats. Thus, any attempt to construct an economic system which will eliminate mistakes, or even some kinds of mistake, is doomed to failure. All we can sensibly do is put in place a system in which mistakes are soonest recognized and most rapidly corrected. And that means, in practice, the liberal capitalist market economy. By contrast, all experience shows that whatever the political system, it is governments that find it hardest to own up to mistakes, still less to correct them. All this is so obvious that it is puzzling that Britain, which more or less invented the market economy, and in Adam Smith's Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, the full title I think is so much more significant than the customary abbreviation, first explained it, should have taken so long after the war to rediscover it. A large part of the explanation can be attributed, I believe, to the influence of that towering polymathic intellect and forceful personality, John Maynard Keynes. Keynes was essentially a Platonist, believing that government policy, including not least economic policy, should be determined by a properly educated and selflessly public-spirited intellectual elite. This remains, incidentally, the ruling tradition in France, which explains the rooted French distrust of the market and a significant part of the French elite's instinctive hostility to the United States. Thus, Keynes believed that investment decisions should not be left to what he described in the general theory as, and I quote, the uncontrollable and disobedient psychology of the business world, but should be to a substantial extent determined by government. Nor should capital flows be left to the market, as he wrote only 5 years before his untimely death in 1946, and I quote once more, nothing is more certain than that the movement of capital funds must be regulated. Now, one insuperable problem, there may be others, but one insuperable problem with economic Platonism is that there are never going to be very many paragons of the kind specified by Plato in the Republic, nor any guarantee that even if they exist, they will be in government. There are not even many Keyneses in every way, about as close to the Platonic model as we're likely to find in the real world. And Keynes himself was distinctly fallible. In particular, over-influenced by the experience of the 1930s, he came to the mistaken conclusion that slump was almost the natural condition of free economies. And it was this error which provided much of the intellectual underpinning of the inflationary disaster of the 1960s and 1970s. But there's perhaps an even more fundamental misconception. Economists, at least since Marshall, have mistakenly sought to dignify their calling by describing it as a science, and increasingly chosen to add verisimilitude to this pretense by clothing their propositions in the language of science, that is to say, mathematics. Now, despite being a one-time mathematician myself, I very much doubt if any Chancellor of the Exchequer has ever been assisted in his task to the slightest extent by a mathematical equation. Because economics is not a science. On scientific matters, we rightly expect a high degree of certainty, and we are ready to leave many important decisions to properly educated experts. By contrast, economic policy, although not identical, is rather more like foreign policy than it is like a science, consisting as it does in seeking a rational course of action in a world of endemic uncertainty. It's to cope with the realities of this sort of world that the new economic consensus which came into being during the course of the 1980s, is so much better fitted than the old. It won't guarantee that the decisions taken will always be proved right, but it makes it much more likely that the worst errors will be avoided, and no one could ask more than that.
Thank you very much, Nigel. Well, we have some time for questions, and I notice that there are a few purveyors of mathematical equations in the hall. Indeed, there's not much else in the LSE, actually. But perhaps they'll be able to contain themselves. I'm happy to take questions, and I hope that when you do ask, you'll be prepared to say who you are and where you're from. And let me look and see. I have one here and one here. George Jones,
ex-LSE. From your experience as Chancellor, Lord Lawson, what is your view about the value of having at number 10 Downing Street a group of advisers of the Prime Minister checking, supervising and advising the Prime Minister about the work of the Treasury?
I will not be drawn too far on this, but I think it is perfectly reasonable for a Prime Minister to have his or her own personal economic advisor. And just as he or she may want a personal advisor on foreign policy. I don't think you need a group, but I think a personal advisor who's independent, say, where the Treasury, who the Prime Minister can say, perfectly reasonable. I've always believed that. But it is important that this should be in private. When a personal advisor starts going public, and so it becomes unclear as to what the economic policy of the government is, then I think it is simply unhelpful. But provided it is a private advice, given frankly, and then you can have a discussion, again, an internal discussion, if there's a difference of views, and thrash it out. I think that's thoroughly healthy.
Take one over here.
My name is Graham Thomas from the University of Reading. Lecture, Rawson, you referred in glowing terms to the quality of the Treasury civil servants, but you also referred to very serious errors in forecasting. And from my recollection, Dennis Healy made exactly the same point. That seems a paradox. Is it a paradox? And if so, can you explain it?
Well, there are different explanations possible. One of them, perhaps, is that short-term forecasting is impossible. So that even the cleverest people and the most industrious and hard-working people I think it is very difficult, and I think that is one of the reasons why one needs as much as possible to have a policy which doesn't depend on forecasts over much. But nevertheless, as you see from the Bank of England's inflation report and the minutes of the Monetary Policy Committee, forecasts have to be used. I think it is sensible for those who are using them, however, to be very sceptical and to be aware of the quite appalling track record that forecasters have had. But in monetary policy, it perhaps doesn't matter quite as much as it might. If that is your active macroeconomic policy, which I believe it should be, it doesn't matter quite as much as in some other forms, the sort of thing that Dennis Healy was talking about, I suspect. Because it is, if you get your forecast wrong, it's rather easier to reverse monetary policy than it is, and with less damage than is the case with most other areas.
Bill Keegan.
Keegan, the Observer. I'd like to begin by calling you Chancellor, because I did for so long in the past. Nigel, you alluded to the Louvre Accord in passing. You were very heavily involved in the Plaza Agreement and the Louvre Accord, which I think you called Plaza 2, just notwithstanding your very strong preaching of leaving it to the market, if you were Chancellor now, would you be getting involved in a Plaza 3, given the imbalances in the world economy, or would you just leave it alone?
I think in the world we now have, I would leave it alone. It's very difficult to answer categorically, Bill, because I haven't given it as much thought as I would have done had I been in office. But I think that in the world of today, it would be very difficult to do something of that kind that worked. It's not because I have some objection in principle to it. I think for a short time it can be helpful. But I think it would be very, very difficult to do something that worked. And therefore it's better not attempt it.
And next to Bill Sushil.
Sushil Vadvanya, hedge fund manager. I just wanted to make sure I understood you clearly in terms of your views about whether it would have been better to have an independent Bank of England in the late 80s, or essentially whether now, in, you know, perhaps with the benefit of hindsight, you know, taking Alan Budd's recent lecture and so on, which you alluded to, that it is now your view that it was okay to use the ERM to try and bring inflation down. The reason I ask the question is, if one looks around the world and looks at other inflation targeting countries like Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and so on, they managed to switch to inflation targeting, switch to an independent central bank, and brought inflation down with a very small rise in unemployment. So the sacrifice ratio was rather better than the sacrifice ratio that eventuated in the UK, which used the ERM.
I had come to the very clear conclusion in 1988, as I say, that we would do well to move to an independent central bank. And I tried very hard to persuade Margaret Thatcher and was unable to do so at the time. And I published in my memoirs the memorandum that I sent her at the time in 1988, setting out what I believed would be sensible. What I was acknowledging, however, was a political point where I think she had a point. Namely, it would have reflected badly on the government, because it would have looked, and this was Alan Budd's point, I think, it would have looked as if the central bank was being asked to succeed because the politicians had given up. They said, we can't do it, which would have reflected badly on the government. And that was a political consideration. Whether it was a sufficient political consideration not to do it in 1988, I don't know, or 1989, I suppose, because it would have taken time to get the legislation through and everything. It certainly could have been done a great deal sooner than 1997, no doubt about that.
Can I ask you one question myself, Nigel, about tax policy, which you didn't perhaps through time cover in any great detail, but one might have argued until relatively recently that another part of your changed consensus, in addition to the belief in low inflation and the sort of view of the roles of macro and micro policy, was a view that the best thing the Treasury could do on the taxation system was to make it as simple as possible, and you always abolished a tax in every budget. And it appeared that that was a consensus, that complicated systems of allowances were a bad idea, you went for simple tax rates, simplification of the system. In the last 7 years, we seem to have completely reversed on that, and the Treasury has become much more interventionist with a lot more tinkering. Is that true? Do you think that element of the consensus has gone under this Chancellor?
Well, if you're talking about the wider tax consensus, there are clearly some continuity. I brought the top rate of income tax down to 40% in 1988, and it has remained at 40% ever since. I'm quite sure that if I hadn't brought it down, then it wouldn't be 40% today. So there some things have endured. One always hopes that what one does will endure, I say, not merely for the good of the country, but also because it's pretty hard work, and to have everything you've done reversed by the next government make you think, what's the point of all that hard work? You are absolutely right on the other part. The idea of tax simplification and having no loopholes, no tax breaks, whether or few tax breaks as possible, whether they are accidental ones, which clever accountants have discovered, or whether they're ones deliberately introduced by the government of the day. That is anathema. That should not happen. You want low rates, but no exceptions, no tax breaks. And there has been, I think, a very sad reversal on that front. You're quite right. I think it's regrettable, and I think it is very much for the worse. So I hope that sense will come back. I hope that this is not a permanent reversal.
Any more? You haven't provoked any of the Greens. Oh, well, perhaps you have. No, you don't have to ask a question about global warming, but if you... and then I've got someone.
Not my field, I'm afraid. Right. Matthew Hancock from the Bank of England. You mentioned the credit boom that occurred in the late 80s and the high expectations of, for income and the house price rises that went with that. I wonder whether you have any insights for what's going on in the market for credit and houses now, drawing on your time, looking at it very closely then.
I suspect it is similar but not the same. It's not the same because although history always does repeat itself, it doesn't repeat itself in an identical way. There are always different features and different things. There was a huge, what is sometimes forgotten is because the consumer credit boom was, and the housing boom was so big and so such obvious talking points at the time, that there was a huge business investment boom at the same time, which is partly, I think, a consequence of deregulation, particularly Big Bang and all that, which meant that a whole lot of international banks and other financial companies were coming to London. There was a huge explosion of business investment in the financial sector. And of course, when you get that sort of mood, then other businesses start investing more. So you had the two things going on at the same time. And we're not getting that other component at the present time. It is just a consumer credit boom, and in particular, a housing boom. So I suspect that there is going to be some bursting of the bubble. Maybe it's already beginning, and I can't predict how far it can go. Nobody can predict these things. That's part of the sort of datum. That's why there will always be a cycle, because you can neither predict it nor can you control it in a free economy. But as I say, I suspect that it will be different and less serious than it was in the late 80s, partly for the reason I've already given, but there's also another reason, which may have been even more important. In the late 80s, it was the first, the 80s were the first cycle in which people had been free to take their own decisions. Financial deregulation changed enormously the picture. Hitherto, what had happened was that consumers wanting credit, whether it was for purchasing houses or for any other reason, were, to a greater or lesser extent, rationed by the government, by the banks or the building societies. And they, in turn, did this because the government was to a considerable extent controlling them, partly by statutory means, things like the corset and all sorts of things like that, partly by statutory means and partly by leaning on them. And they were accustomed to looking to the government to take their decisions for them. The late 80s, everybody was suddenly liberated. And not only did consumers feel that sort of did not feel the need for self-discipline, which you need in this free framework, but neither, unfortunately, did the financial institutions, who really went mad. Now, I'm not saying they should have been helping the government, they should have been helping themselves, because it was they who, by their folly, incurred all the bad debts, which took a long time to work through. So it was, this, as I say, was the first cycle in the post-war era of freedom. And I think people have learned from that. Not totally. People never do. They only, in a total sense, people are only able to learn from their own experience. They never learn from the experience of previous generations. But you learn a little.
Another one down here. And then you.
Well, you might as well have a dictator deciding everything. No, I don't think for a moment that would help. It is possible for chancellors and prime ministers to work very closely together. It may not look like it at the moment, but it is possible. I mean, during the vast part of my time as chancellor, I worked extremely closely and very happily with Margaret Thatcher, and there was absolutely no problem at all. It only came towards the end. So that I think, and the, you know, prime ministers don't need to be terribly interested in this area. Margaret Thatcher, of course, was passionately interested in this area. I don't think that the present prime minister is interested in the slightest. No, I think that you do need a Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I'm speaking in a totally dispassionate way because I'm not applying for the job in any future government. But I do think you do need a Chancellor of the Exchequer. And I do think, this sounds terribly conservative with a small c, but I do think that the system we have in this country, where, as it were, the role of finance minister and the control of and the role of economics minister and the role of control of public expenditure are all under one department and one minister, is, I think, very much better than in many other countries in the United States, where, for example, control of public expenditure does not come in under the Treasury. In many European countries, you have a distinction between the finance minister and the economics minister, and you have one responsible for taxation and the other one responsible for public expenditure. Well, of course, you know, there has to be some kind of bringing together of the two sides of the national accounts. So I think the fact that we put all that in one department with one minister, I think is better for what I call policy coherence. But I would not merge numbers 10 and 11 Downing Street.
Next one, just in the second row here.
Thank you, Lord Lawson. Just like to get your view. You're talking about the supremacy of market efficiencies, and I just wanted your view on structural adjustment policies of the World Bank, in particular advocating liberalisation of agricultural markets, yet do you think there's a hypocrisy there with the degree of protection that we have in the Western world?
Well, I think, I'm not in favour of, I don't think it's a hypocrisy, I'm not in favour of protection at all, and I have made many speeches, but you did anyhow when I was Chancellor, attacking agricultural protection in the United States, in the European Union, and indeed in Japan, where in many ways the level of protection is the worst, the highest. But that doesn't mean, you know, you do your best to fight that, but that doesn't mean it's hypocrisy to urge countries to to open up their markets if you think that that is in their benefit. And if you look at, let's say two things about globalization, which bear on that in totally different ways. One is that if you look at those third world countries, to use an old-fashioned expression, those third world countries which have opened up, to a certain extent, to the global economy, and those that have decided not to, and nobody is forced to, you know, no government is forced to, then it is absolutely clear, I think, that those that have, for all the difficulties they discover, have fared far better than those like Cuba or wherever who have turned their backs on the global economy. The other connection, if I may ask, the other connection is that globalization has meant that you're no longer, as a developing country, you're not dependent on World Bank money in the way that these countries used to be, because there is a huge, far bigger private capital market, which if you're pursuing policies which have the confidence of that market, you can tap. So that's, I think, good news. I think globalization is very good news for the third world in that way.
Second row on the side, thanks.
Thanks very much.
You talked very glowingly about the economic consensus, but I'm wondering if there are not some downsides that I might just refer to. For instance, when one travels around the European continent, one is struck by the marked disparities in the qualities and the efficiency of the infrastructure they have, their transportation infrastructure and so on, the medical services and so on, in contrast to Britain. And I'm wondering whether you might say that partly
I'll say three things, if I may. First of all, you know, the grass on the other side is always greener. I live half my time in France nowadays and half my time in England. And I wouldn't do that if I didn't love to be in France. But, you know, they have all sorts of problems too, and they're very happy to talk to you about them over a glass or two of wine or flock, as a normal drink at night, neck of the woods. And the train service, it does run on time, but there are many fewer lines and many fewer trains. It's a different way of approaching it. As for the their healthcare, I think it is a better setup than the much more socialist healthcare setup we have in this country. But it is a major problem if you read the French press. I mean, it is creaking at the seams, and they're hugely worried about what to do about it. The other thing I would say is a remark, the underinvestment in the railways was an underinvestment which occurred well before privatization, well before the 1980s. There'd been a history of underinvestment there because it was a nationalized industry, and the dead hand of the Treasury was not in favor of spending money on this if it could avoid it. So I don't think that it is a criticism of the new consensus. Finally, manufacturing. There is nothing special about manufacturing. What you want is a successful economy. And if manufacturing firms are finding it harder because the third world is doing more and more in manufacturing, whereas it is the service sectors where there's a huge growth potential, then that's not a disaster. In fact, if you try and resist that, you're being very silly.
Third row on the... Sam Britton.
Samuel Britton, Financial Times, loosely attached. As this is an academic institution, theoretical question. Towards the end of your speech, Mr. Ex-Chancellor, you poured scorn on the idea of economics as a science, and you mentioned foreign policy as well. But I've been thinking about this. Is it not the case that any action, whether in economic policy or in foreign policy, presupposes some set of cause and effect relationships? They may only be probable, but they are presupposed. And isn't it the job of the social sciences, including economics, to make these implicit relationships explicit and to test them as far as possible? This may or may not mean econometrics. We can have an open mind on which methods will prove successful. And you can see, actually, in international relations, a far greater range of models and a far greater range of approaches than is nowadays used in mainstream economic institutions. Discuss.
I'm tempted just to say yes, which I think is what your question deserves. But but I don't want to be unkind. Samuel, we've known each other for a very long time, so I don't want to be unkind. What I would say is that I think that the best way of understanding these relationships is not through mathematical equations, which, you know, what you put into the model is what you get out of it anyway. The best way of understanding these things is through understanding economic history. I greatly regret that when I read PPE at Oxford a million years ago, I was primarily a philosopher, so I only did two economics papers, but they were economic theory and economic organization. There was no economic history paper at all. You had to do it as a special subject, optional extra, and so on. I think that probably in this country, maybe the LSE is totally different, but not sufficient time is devoted to economic history. You learn about these relations far better that way. It's almost as if in politics, you did, if you were studying politics, you studied political theory and political institutions, but no political history. That would be ludicrous. It's equally ludicrous, I believe, in economics.
You said, no doubt, the LSE is different as a throwaway line, anticipating that it wasn't. But actually, we have the only freestanding economic history department left in the country. What I'm going to do is, we're sort of at the end of our time, slightly beyond. I'm going to take... I'm not going to take everybody. I was going to take these two questions together, and then we'll stop, I think. A man in a sort of purpley kind of T-shirt, and then...
Hello. Benjamin Kahn, SOAS. With all due respect, Mr. Chancellor, I dare not say, but Lord Lawson, don't you feel that on the Euro topic you misrepresent the issue slightly by saying it's a completely political union and downplaying the economic effects of it in two ways? You say it's an inevitable failure due to the huge differentiation between the European countries, when in fact nation states which have huge differences, like China, in the US, successfully run a single currency. And secondly, you misrepresented by saying that we lose the ability to set monetary policy, when in fact we lose the ability to set an interest rate, but the Bank of England would retain reserve ratios, deposit ratios, even their own bank regulations over the UK system. And do you not feel there is more to be said about this topic?
Thanks. I'll take this one as well, and then you too, as long as it's quick.
It's Chris Giles from the Financial Times. Just with respect, listening to a talk like you is a bit like, at the moment, hearing a speech by Gordon Brown in terms of the consensus, because he's always talking about the progressive consensus that he says he's created now of higher health, education spending and redistribution to, quote, hardworking families. Just to stop us all agreeing, can you say, if you'd had his inheritance, what you would have done different?
And then the third, and I'll just take the last one there. Blue striped shirt, yep.
Andreas Weizmann, private sector. I didn't quite understand the relationship you drew between the Maastricht Treaty and the end or demise of the ERM, and maybe you could elaborate.
Right. A number of different things. As for what I would do in Gordon Brown's, which I indicate in answer to Howard Davies' question, I would certainly not have complicated the tax system in the way that he does. The way in which you get improved productivity, and he's right to say it would be nice if we had higher productivity in this country, is not to try and micromanage the economy. It is to create a framework in which businesses can perform and are likely to perform better and are stimulated to perform better. The two questions about Europe. Now, I don't think the Maastricht Treaty point is quite a simple one. That there was once the framers of the Maastricht Treaty, Jacques Delors and others, had said, well, we have got to have a single currency because the EMS is no longer sufficient. We ourselves don't believe in it. Then clearly it has no market credibility. I think market credibility would have diminished as the size of capital flows was increasing anyway. But certainly when they, as it were, for political reasons, said that this is no longer sustainable, we have got to move to a single currency. Clearly this no longer, this idea had, as a discipline, no longer had any credibility. So that's the connection, which I think is a fairly obvious one. As for whether I've misstated, no. I mean, everybody on the continent of Europe accepts that this is a political... there's nothing disgraceful about being political. I'm a politician. I was a politician. There's nothing disgraceful, but let's be only open about it. Let's not have any subterfuge. There's not just one political agenda, because different countries involved in it have different political agendas. But it is political. As I say, I don't criticize people for having that. But one either may not be prepared, may not share the political agenda that, say, the French have. Even though I love France, and I say live half the time in France, but I may not share their political agenda. Equally, one may feel that it is not worth paying an economic price in order to secure this presumed political objective. That is the point. And I don't believe there's any, to use a term very popular with Howard in his previous incarnation, I don't think there's any mis-selling about that.
Well, thank you very much, Nigel. We ought to stop. We've gone 5 minutes over our normal time. Just want to say, when we asked the various chancellors to come and speak to us, we of course insisted that there should be no conferring before they came to speak. But in fact, there has been a fascinating dovetailing of what we have heard from Dennis Healy first, and then from Geoffrey Howe last week, and now to you, which has really begun to tell a fascinating story. And I can hardly wait for next week's instalment next Tuesday. We've slightly finessed John Major, though. He will come and talk to us, but he wants to come and talk more broadly about his political experience, because his time as Chancellor was, of course, really rather brief. So Norman Lamont is next Tuesday. But thank you very much, Nigel, for an extremely thoughtful piece tonight. In spite of the fact that you demolished almost the whole of the LSE except for the Economic History Department, with a mere aside, we will just about forgive you that, because you gave us a fascinating insight into policymaking at the time, but also set it into a broader context, which has been extremely useful and very thought-provoking. Thank you very much for coming along.